Welcome once again to our Bible study group. We're so glad that you've decided to join us. We're doing a series on so-called background characters in the Old Testament. These are people who maybe didn't make the front lines. They're not the big names that everybody knows about in the Bible. But these are characters who nevertheless had a significant impact because of one thing or another they did or what kind of people they were. And our character for this time is Jonathan. Jonathan, you will remember, was the son, the firstborn son of King Saul, the first king of Israel, and a very, very close friend of David, the second king of Israel. So you see, he was sort of sandwiched there between two big names, and we therefore call him Jonathan, born to greatness. Let's begin our study together with prayer. Our loving Father, once again we turn to Scripture. We plead for your presence, the presence of the Holy Spirit, to guide us as we look through these materials and these words that you've given us so that we may understand more clearly these stories from your holy book, is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Mm-hmm. Well, as we mentioned, this is the story of two Bible greats, Saul and David. But it focuses on that background character between them, Jonathan. Jonathan, of course, was Saul's eldest son, who, after David joined the king's household, became his best friend. We're going to talk about how that happened in just a moment. Where's the first time we hear anything about Jonathan? It's a very interesting place, and I'd like you to turn in your Bibles, if you will, to 1 Samuel 13, verse 1. And would one of you read that to me? Whichever translation you have handy there.
Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 42 years over Israel.
Okay.
That was a guess on the part of the translators there. Because nobody knows.
30 and 40 are in italics. So
yes. Yeah, it actually says Saul was blank years old when he began to reign, and he reigned blank in 2 years. That's what the Hebrew text actually says. Very.
Peterson does it this way. He says, Saul was a young man when he began as king, and he was king over Israel for many years.
That's one way to do it. But why would that be in there like that?
They didn't know exactly and didn't get back there to fix it before somebody found it many years later.
Okay, this, following the form.
Yes, it's very interesting. If you read on through and look, the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, every one of them will have such and such an age when I began to reign, and I reigned for so and so many years. Standard formula. So when they're talking about Saul, writing this down, they said, we better put that. Let's see, how well, you know, and apparently they didn't know for sure, and so they went on. It's very unlikely that this came later. I mean, why would someone just leave out the numbers? That doesn't make any sense at all. So we think that the person who wrote this down in the beginning wrote it like that with the intention of coming back later and filling in and whatever, apparently never got the information or something and never did. It tells us something about the inspiration of the Bible because that mistake has been copied very, very carefully for thousands of years. I mean, why didn't somebody just come, look at Joanne's Bible. They fixed it.
In italics.
What? Dr. Thiele wrote a book on it and got his PhD on it.
Yep. Well, not just on that verse, but on
but numbering the kings of Israel.
Yep.
And he studied. I was at EMC when he was there, and he was a brilliant man to listen to and to study under because he knew that.
Yeah, did he solve this problem?
Yes.
Partly.
To his satisfaction, he
did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to hear because I've done that before in schoolwork where I'd write about something at some date and something I didn't know what it was. I left it blank going back later. Uh-huh. So it looks like he just didn't get back to it or he looked and...
Which tells us that the Bible isn't dictated by God. Mm-hmm. God inspired writers to put it down. Someone was writing this. There's a pretty good chance it was Samuel that first wrote this book. And he should have known, or at least he thought he knew, He wanted the formula to be there so that someone could do the calculations later, because these dates are very important in genealogic records. But apparently he never got back to it.
Well, I've called Jim a couple times on some things,
mm-hmm.
and some facts, and
yeah.
and I just left it. I put on a little note, call Jim.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I know, sometimes I don't know. So
yeah. The dates and numbers in the Bible, you have to be very careful yeah. with them.
Yeah, they do. Because the ancient language, the numbering system they used then, I mean, we think, oh, yeah, a zero means 10 and all that kind of stuff. They had none of that kind of stuff in those days. Nobody had invented the zero. The numbering system was completely different. We're not even sure what some of those numbers meant. So we have to read the numbers in the Bible, these really old numbers, with a grain of salt.
Little teeny footnote here. The Hebrew version omits 30. The Hebrew omits 40.
Yes.
So you have to read the very teeny print.
What translation is that?
It's that New American Standard, is it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In my translation, the Good News Bible, the whole first verse is in the footnote.
Yeah.
It starts with verse 2.
Yes.
Oh.
Exactly. In fact, there's not even, in my biblical version, as you can see there, there's not even a 13 to mark the beginning of the chapters. It's 12, and then all of a sudden, hey, it started renumbering verses here. What's going on? And then there's chapter 14.
Mm.
So anyway, that's a little sidetrack, but it's an interesting little detail that teaches something about God and how he inspires people and not words. Well, Saul picked 3,000 men, keeping 2,000 of them with him in Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, sending 1,000 with his son Jonathan to Gibeah. Now, this is the first thing that we read about Jonathan in the Bible, and I think we have to assume that whoever wrote this, and it may have been Samuel, probably wrote these stories in chronological sequence. So when this is the first mention of Jonathan, it's probably, the first time he actually did something. And here he is already mature enough, apparently, to be a general. The rest of the men Saul sent home. Jonathan killed the Philistine. Now, again, here's another example. Jonathan killed the Philistine commander in Gibeon. All the Philistines heard about it. Now, it may mean that he killed the commander, or that passage may mean he and his men went up there and killed the whole group of Philistines who were in that city. We just don't know. But then Saul sent messengers to call the Hebrews to war because he knew what was going to happen, didn't he? By blowing a trumpet throughout the whole country, all the Israelites were told that Saul had killed the Philistine commander and that the Philistines hated them. So the people answered the call to join Saul at Gilgal and so forth. So the first thing we hear about Jonathan is he's stirring up war. Notice Jonathan has 1,000 men with him. Saul has a couple thousand with him. We're going to read a little bit later, if we get there, that a lot of them were deserting, so there was probably only half that many by the time the war started. And look what the Philistines had. The Philistines assembled to fight the Israelites. They had 30,000 war chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and as many soldiers as there are grains of sand on the seashore. I mean, what kind of a battle is that?
When you put that in modern perspective, if you look at a timeline of the development of recorded history of warfare in this world, a chariot with horses was a rough equivalent to our tank today.
Mm-hmm.
It gave them mobility and speed.
Mm-hmm.
And up to that point, it was infantry man-to-man.
Mm-hmm.
It's staggering when you see what they had here.
Mm-hmm. Really? It's so staggering that critics of the Bible say, these numbers can't be true.
Yeah.
Well, you know. Okay, well, that was the introduction we have to Jonathan. It was not until the second year of Saul's reign that an attempt was made to subdue the Philistines. The first blow, and remember, at this point in time, what do we know what was going on between the Philistines and the Hebrews?
The Philistines were running riot over the country, doing whatever they wanted when they wanted.
Yep, exactly. The Hebrews were basically, serving the Philistines. So the first blow was struck by Jonathan, who at the command of his father attacked and overcame their garrison at Geba. Now see, here it has a whole garrison being attacked. The Philistines were greatly exasperated by this defeat, and they made ready for a speedy attack upon Israel. So, now, here's our young man. The first thing we hear about him, he's stirring up war, he's attacking garrisons with greatly odd numbers. I mean, he has just a few, and there's huge numbers of them. He's winning battles. I mean, what would you expect a young man like that to think about himself? I'm pretty important, right? I'm one of the leaders of this nation.
I'm the next king.
I'm the next king. Yeah. So why didn't he grow up to be a spoiled, greedy, selfish, arrogant young man?
He must have had a good mother.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he must have had a good mother. Where else could he have gotten it from?
I don't think a spoiled man would be in the army. He would avoid the draft.
A spoiled man could be the head of the army.
Yeah, okay.
It depends.
Just think of how fierce of a warrior those guys were to attack, you know, this army that, mm-hmm. that, you know, could come down any time and just overrun them. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys must have been just incredible.
Yeah.
Just hard to believe what they would do, you know, with their little tiny swords.
Yeah. Later we read that Saul and Jonathan were the only ones in the entire army who had any regular weapons. The other guys were fighting with clubs and things you can make out of wood and that kind of stuff because the Philistines didn't allow them even any blacksmiths in Israel. I mean, how do you fight a war like that?
Well, in verse 7, it's kind of funny. The people were following Saul. All the people followed him trembling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're going out to war. Yeah.
Here's Jonathan's attitude. It's chapter 14, about verse 6. Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come on now, let's go across to these uncircumcised pagans. Maybe God will work for us. There's no rule that says God can only deliver by using a big army. No one can stop God from saying when he sets his mind to do it."
We're going to read about that in just a minute. I'm not quite ready for that yet.
What an attitude.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, maybe.
Now, did Jonathan have a upbringing where he was really grounded in God? We haven't talked about how. Oh, it doesn't say.
We don't know for sure. We do know the name of his mother. We know the name of his father. We know his father was mentally ill.
Well, he was. He wasn't at the beginning.
No.
I mean, he was. I think he was a pretty upright person.
Yeah.
He was physically big and big. All that.
What kind of mental illness?
Well, it's hard to know for sure. He was depressed. Sometimes he act paranoid. We don't know. Since this story is really focusing on the friendship between David and Jonathan, what do we know about friendship? What does the Bible tell us about friendship?
Were they approximately the same age?
Probably close.
Friends can stick closer than a brother. So
friends can stick closer than a brother. That's Proverbs. Anything else? You remember what it says about God and Moses?
They were friends.
They were friends. And they spoke face to face. God and Abraham. Abraham spoke with God face to face. He was God's friend. Job. What does it say about Job?
God's friend.
Yeah. If a person falls down, if you got a friend, the friend will help you back up. If you get into trouble, the friend will defend you. And I like what it says over in John 15, 13 to 15. Let's just go there for a second. John 15, 13 to 15. The greatest love a person can have for his friends is to give his life for them. And you are my friends. This is Jesus speaking to his disciples on his last night with them. And you are my friends if you do what I command you. Now, that doesn't sound so much like friends. That sounds more like servants, doesn't it? I do not call you servants any longer. Now, the word there is actually slaves. I do not call you slaves any longer because servants do not know what their master is doing. So what's the difference between a slave and a friend?
They talk things over.
They talk things over. A friend understands his friend, right?
Instead, knows what's going on.
Yeah. Exactly. Instead, I call you friends because I have told you everything I have heard from my Father. That's incredible. Jesus says, I want you to be my friends. And what did he mean when he said, I want you to be my friends?
Understand me.
Understand me. I want you to understand me. I want you to become more. And understanding, you know, by beholding we become changed. Understanding him, we become more like him. Well, yeah.
Probably for a different discussion, but that seems to be in so much distinction to here are my laws, get with the program, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what would Jesus say to us today? Would he say, I'd like to be your friends instead of being just have you be my servants? What would we need to know to become real friends of God? Wouldn't we need to know what God's plans are?
We would need to know the kind of person God is.
Mm-hmm.
Need to know God.
If we would want to be his friend.
Mm-hmm.
Is it know God and know the Father and know Jesus, and that's eternal life. John 17.
Mm-hmm.
Eternal
mm-hmm.
life is to know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom thou hast sent.
Yeah, exactly. John 17, that was Jesus' prayer at the end of his life.
And
there, wasn't
he says, I've accomplished the work you gave me to do. I've glorified you. And he hadn't died yet.
Yeah. Well, one of the best things about friends is that we get to choose them. It is a completely voluntary relationship. Solomon tells us there are times when a friend will stick closer to a brother. You mentioned that, Proverbs 18:24. Was Solomon thinking of his father and Jonathan? I don't know. Maybe so, when he wrote that. You know, sometimes there are friends that stick closer than a brother.
Are we going to study instances where they stuck closer than a...
Yeah, yeah. Well, we mentioned already the 30,000 war chariots, the 6,000 horsemen and so forth. They were faced by Samuel and Jonathan. That should be Saul and Jonathan leading only 3,000 men. The Philistine army was basically making havoc in Judah. Warring parties were traveling around, killing people, stealing things, and generally terrorizing the Israelites. The Philistines forbade the Israelites even have blacksmiths in their territory lest they make weapons. As a result, the Israelites had to go to the Philistines to get their plows, hoes, axes, and sickles sharpened. If you even want to harvest your field, you got to go down to the Philistines to sharpen your sickle. So when the Israelites stirred up war with the Philistines, only Saul and Jonathan had swords or spears. I mean, it's like kids playing against a military machine here.
Yeah.
Well, as the two armies were camped near each other, Jonathan, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, spoke with his armor bearer, and they decided to cross over, this is what you mentioned, Norm, mm-hmm. where there was a small group of Philistines and challenged them. And the Philistines at this point, obviously, they didn't feel threatened at all. In fact, there are hints that Israelites were deserting their own army to join the Philistines because they just it looked so hopeless to them. They didn't want to be part of a losing army. So the Philistines were just sending groups out. Just, I'm going to go down to Bethlehem. I'm going to go down here. We're going to raid and steal and rape and so forth. And then we'll come back tonight. And, you know, that was the sort of thing that was going on. Well, Jonathan set up a sign to determine if God was guiding them. As a result of a positive outcome to the sign, Jonathan and his friend climbed on their hands and knees over the rough rocks up to the top of this pass. They held all the high ground. There they were up top of the pass, and they saw these guys. Oh, look at they're crawling out of the holes in the rocks down there. Hey, yeah, what you doing down there? You know, that was in the days when you shouldn't shoot rifles at people. You know, longest weapon you had was maybe a spear. Well, Jonathan said, if they give us the right signal, we're going to go up there. But was this just a fluke idea of Jonathan's? Well, once again, an inspired writer spoke up and said, Jonathan, the king's son, a man who feared God, was chosen as the instrument to deliver Israel. Moved by a divine impulse, he proposed to his armor bearer that they should make a secret attack upon the enemy's camp. It may be here, and there's the verses that you read, that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to work by many or by few. That's in Signs of the Times, August 10, 1882. These two men, reading on, from Youth Instructor, November 24, 1898, these two men gave evidence that they were moving under the influence and command of a more than human general. To outward appearances, their venture was rash and contrary to all military rules. But the action of Jonathan was not done in human rashness. He depended not on what he and his armor bearer themselves could do. He was the instrument that God used in behalf of his people Israel. They made their plans, rested their cause in the hands of God, If the armies of the Philistines challenged them, they would advance. If they said, come, they would go forward. This was their sign, and the angels of God prospered them. They went forward saying, and maybe the Lord will work with us. Well, the Philistines apparently thought that these people were abandoning their own army to join them. They were not expecting slaughter from these two men that were just sort of climbing up on their hands and knees. And when you look down the hill and these guys are, the hill is so steep they're climbing up on their hands and knees, do you think you're going to be threatened? Here's a whole bunch of armed men at the top of the hill, you know. You think, you know, you sort of watch them a while and then you can't see them anymore. It's no big deal, right? Suddenly there was an earthquake and great panic. The Philistines turned on each other and began killing each other, thinking they were enemies. Meanwhile, Saul, realizing something was happening in the Philistine camp, wondered who was missing and found out that it was Jonathan and his armor bearer. Soon the Israelites were pursuing the Philistines in every direction. Well, it would have been easy, again, I read from the pen of Ellen White, it would have been an easy matter for the Philistines to kill these two brave, daring men, but it did not enter into their minds that these two solitary men had come up with any hostile intent. They wonder, the wandering men above looked on, too surprised to take their possible object. They regarded these men as deserters, permitted them to come without harm. I mean, imagine, how does God work? Here was a very interesting way that God worked in this case.
He provided an earthquake to cause confusion.
Yeah, among other things. Yeah. Well, as a result, what happened?
Well, Israel chased them all over the place.
Yeah. Instead of the Israelites being chased all over the place by the Philistines first of all began killing each other, and then when the Israelites sort of figured out what was going on, they started chasing, and they're chasing the Philistines in every direction. Saul, trying to make the most of a good thing, forbade his soldiers from eating anything so they could spend full time pursuing and killing the Philistines. As a result, they were very weak by the end of the day. They'd been fighting all day long. They hadn't had anything to eat. They began to slaughter sheep and cattle, eating the meat with the blood still in it, which was completely against kosher law. Jonathan, not knowing about the prohibition, had eaten some honey from a honeycomb in the forest. Now, which do you think was worse, having a few bites of honey or eating raw meat?
What do you mean, not knowing about the prohibition?
Well, he and his armor bearer were out there doing their best trying to fight the battle. And when Saul started out to help them with his army, he says, we've got a job to do here. I don't want anybody taking a bite of anything. Just fight, fight, fight. Jonathan didn't know that. He was already out there fighting. So he goes through the forest, and here's a place where there's apparently a lot of honey, bees and honey hanging on the trees, and he whacked off a piece and had some.
So he was not supposed to eat, but just keep fighting, and he ate.
By the order of the king.
By order of the king, which he didn't know anything about.
Oh, well. Mm-hmm. If you don't know, there's an
blood
order.
Blood sugar is way down.
Yeah.
Well, go on. You see, Jonathan, he had the honey and got a battery charge.
Saul, maybe we should go back and look at this story. Saul sought the high priest to consult God as to whether they should continue pursuing the Philistines. But God did not answer. Saul assumed that someone had committed a sin. By drawing lots, he said, we'll draw lots. My son and I will be on this side, and all the rest of the armies of Israel will be on that side. Can you imagine his shock when the lot fell on him and his son? Saul was prepared to kill his firstborn son because of his oath, but the people said no, and thank goodness they did. Thus, a great victory was cut short. Here they are casting lots, trying to decide which one of them is going to be killed instead of pursuing their enemies. But a great disaster was averted. Jonathan was not killed.
So it actually was a sin to eat the honey?
No.
Oh.
It was just, the king was determined that he wanted to exercise his power and his authority, and he wanted to tell people what to do, and he expected people to do it. Which is sort of what you expect from a king, an ancient.
As we go back in history, this was not God's plan.
No.
They had wandered completely away from God's plan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, why were they being completely dominated by the Philistines? That wasn't God's plan.
No.
Not at all.
I have a question. Well, first of all, two questions. Nothing happened when they didn't eat kosher meat. It doesn't seem like it. And then second of all, we find kosher meat in the grocery store today. Does that have the blood drained out before?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You look in the Jewish section of the supermarket, the rabbi.
Well, my nephew eats some meat, and so then I go and buy this kosher ground turkey, and I was curious. It looked kind of dry to me, so.
But they have all kinds of kosher foods, too.
The Muslims are supposed to do the same.
Mm.
I don't know if they follow quite as strictly as the Jews do, but they...
This is Hebrew kosher, it says.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of not following God's plan, even having the king, or shall I say, especially having the king, Saul, was not according to God's plan.
Yeah.
That was a direct rejection of God as their leader.
Mm-hmm. Well, just read. You asked about the story. Let's just read the verses. Look at 1 Samuel 14, starting with verse 24. The Israelites were weak with hunger that day because Saul, with a solemn oath, had given the order, "A curse be on anyone who eats any food today before I take revenge on my enemies." So it was all about who? Before I take revenge on my enemies, right? So nobody had eaten anything at all. They all came into a wooded area and found honey everywhere. The woods were full of honey, but no one ate any of it because they were all afraid of Saul's curse. But Jonathan had not heard of his father. He heard his father threaten the people with a curse. So he reached out with the stick he was carrying, dipped it in a honeycomb, and ate some honey. At once he felt much better, but one of the men said, "We are all weak with hunger, but your father threatened us and said, 'A curse be on anyone who eats any food today.'" Jonathan answered, "What a terrible thing my father has done to our people. See how much better I feel because I ate some honey." There's your blood sugar being low. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me it's an indication of Saul's poor judgment. Yeah. I mean, you got hand-to-hand combat, you got to eat.
Yeah.
Even today, that's one of the crucial things, food.
Yeah. How much better would it have been today if our people had eaten the food they took when they defeated the enemy? Just think how much more Philistines they would have killed.
But this is kind of a turnaround. I mean, Saul's been seeing his people desert, going every which way. And all of a sudden, here's a chance to chase the army, and he wants them all to do that instead of desert.
Yeah.
I once heard a minister talking about this situation and said that Saul needed to see an ophthalmologist. Mm-hmm. He had eye trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Saul didn't consult God. He didn't say, "God is leading us." He didn't say, "God will help us." Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Part of his eye problem.
There must have been something happening with the enemy, though.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there was.
Because they were equipped, completely equipped.
Yeah.
These guys had nothing, and yet they were beating them. Mm-hmm. So they must have been confused. There must have been.
Well,
their brains must have been out of it or something.
They were fighting each other. The Philistines were fighting each other, and then the Israelites came and pursued them.
And so Saul was just saying, "Let's make hay while the sun shines here. Let's don't eat. Let's get it done in case it stops all of a sudden."
And some of the Israelite deserters who had joined the Philistines turned back against the Philistines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, going back to our story now, we're talking about Jonathan. What do we know about his family? Well, Saul had five named children. Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua were his sons, and Merab and Michal were his daughters. They apparently were all children of Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. So, we give her some credit. Jonathan turned out so well. We don't know so much about the others, but Jonathan turned out so well. Maybe his mother was responsible.
And who is Ahimaaz? Who is she, the daughter?
Ahimaaz was from a priestly family, I understand.
Okay.
Yeah. If the biblical sequence is correct, David first met Jonathan when the Lord's spirit left Saul and an evil spirit sent by the Lord tormented him. Now we come with one of the big questions. We talked in our lesson for last week about how Satan was working in the story of Samuel and Hannah. Look at this. God sends an evil spirit on Saul so that David will come to cheer him up by playing his harp. I mean, who's doing what here?
My question there is, did God send him, or was God protecting him and stopped protecting him?
Okay.
Well, you go back to chapter 10.
I know what it says here, but what does the original say? It could be either or there.
Mm-hmm. In chapter 10, verse 9, it says, when he turned his back to leave Samuel, God gave him another heart. Is that talking about, about Saul?
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, God gave Saul a new heart.
Yeah.
So now later on, he's been
God gives him a... So they attribute it, isn't that what they attribute? Whatever happens, God's doing it. Mm-hmm. Everything.
It's like God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Yeah.
And same thing here.
Pharaoh hardened his own heart, and
Pharaoh's heart was hardened.
All within mm-hmm. three verses.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't pray to God and have God with us, doesn't it leave a space for an evil spirit to jump in?
Well, look at the verses. Look at 1 Samuel 16, starting with verse 14. This is the verse we were just mentioning. The Lord's spirit left Saul, and an evil spirit sent by the Lord, notice Lord in small caps, meaning Yahweh, sent by Yahweh, tormented him. His servant said to him, "We know that an evil spirit sent by God is tormenting you. So give us the order, sir, and we will look for a man who knows how to play the harp. Then when the evil spirit comes on you, the man can play his harp and you'll be all right again." So what does harp playing have to do with evil spirits?
That's good. Good music calms the nerves, perhaps.
Okay.
So they attributed it to God or the spirits.
Mm-hmm. Well, Saul ordered them, "Find me a man who plays well and bring him to me." And one of his attendants said, "Jesse, of the town of Bethlehem, which was a few miles away, has a son who is a good musician. He is also a brave and handsome man, a good soldier, and an able speaker. The Lord is with him." So Saul sent messengers to Jesse to say, "Send me your son David, the one who takes care of the sheep." Jesse sent David to Saul with a young goat, a donkey. I mean, when the king says, "Send me your son," what do? You know, you better make it. You know, do your best to present an offering to the king, right?
Crack to it.
A donkey loaded with bread and a leather bag full of wine. David came to Saul and entered his service. Saul liked him very much and chose him as the man to carry his weapons. So I guess for a little while, at least, David was Saul's armor bearer, huh?
Yeah.
Then Saul sent a message to Jesse, "I like David. Let him stay here in my service." From then on, whenever the evil spirit sent by God came on Saul, David, notice, this is the third or fourth or fifth time it mentions an evil spirit sent by God. David would get his harp and play it. The evil spirit would leave and Saul would feel better again and be all right again. So, I mean, here, this is clearly a case of depression, presumably, or something like that. He hears the music, hears the good music, and he cheers up, right?
But well, it says God did it. Are you going to get him off the hook?
Well, we've already talked about the fact that in their opinion, anything that happened, everything that happened, God was responsible. That's the way they looked at things in those days. You know, because they didn't have bad gods and good gods. So if it happened, God, the one God, must be responsible. That was the attitude.
You think they could have understood that Satan was around at that time, or? Maybe they couldn't take that information because they'd just make him into a god.
Maybe so. Well, I mean, that's a possibility. The Bible, I mean, look at the first couple of chapters of Job. Those were written a long time ago. Genesis, the first few chapters written a long time ago. They all clearly talk about Satan.
Yeah, but even in Job, God sent Satan down, let him go and do his work. So you could still say he came from God.
No. He said, "Have you noticed my servant Job?"
Well, that's true, but I'm talking about afterwards. He says, "Well, all you have to do is do such and such and such and such, and he'll curse you in your face."
Yeah.
And then what did God do? Say, "Go ahead and do it, but don't kill him." Mm-hmm. So he was sent by God.
Well, he was allowed by God.
Well, still... Well, you're picking things apart here.
But aren't you learning about God in trials? Isn't that, you know, go back to Genesis 3. Yep, now they're like one of us. They know good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
Well, doesn't
if you're going to know God, be like God, you got to know good and evil. That's the way the universe runs.
Well, nothing happens in the universe without God's permission.
Okay.
So you can go right back then and say that if something bad happens, it came from God.
So everything the devil does, God is responsible?
No, I just said that ultimately, he let it happen.
Isaiah 45:7, "I create light, I create darkness. I make weal, I make woe, I'm God, I do all these things."
Yeah.
God says that. I didn't say it. It was Isaiah in Isaiah 4.
Well, that's because he's the ultimate creator.
That's right.
So, well, sometime later,
Doesn't God maneuver around us sinful people like Rahab, the prostitute? He knew her heart, and she was in the line of Jesus even. And Ruth, he maneuvered to get her to meet Boaz. And
even did a little family planning?
Yeah, and David, now he's maneuvering, he's using Saul's evil tendencies to get David into a position to be...
To learn about the royal courts and how to behave and... And how you know,
and to benefit the future
educational
people.
Opportunities.
Yep. But if you carry that too far, then God's responsible for everything.
Well, in a sense, that's true.
He takes responsibility.
Well, it is.
He takes responsibility.
He's the creator.
Well, sometime later, the Philistines came with their army into Judea territory and camped near Sokol. The Israelite army, much smaller with virtually no weapons, lined up on a hill facing the Philistine army. The famous story of Goliath and David was the result. And this is where most people know about the story starting. They don't know about all the stuff we've talked about so far. The king had promised his oldest daughter in marriage to whomever killed Goliath. So who was supposed to get his oldest daughter? David. Yeah. He also promised that the killer's family would no longer have to pay taxes. How does that sound?
Wow.
As a result of his victory, Saul wanted David to serve him at his home. He became one of the king's most trusted soldiers and a very close friend of Jonathan. And let's just read those words. Those words are key to our understanding of this lesson. First
Did he
Samuel 8.
End up marrying this prize
no.
that he won?
He did not. By the time he's around a little while, all of a sudden he realized that she was promised to somebody else and married off to somebody else.
Yeah. Well, the king might ask these people if they even want to do what he's...
You mean as if the king's daughters might have something to say about it?
Yeah, or David.
That way there.
Yeah. Well, Saul and David finished their conversation. After that, Saul's son Jonathan was deeply attracted to David and came to love him as much as he loved himself. Now, there is quite a story. Saul kept David with him from that day on and did not let him go back home. Jonathan swore eternal friendship with David because of his deep affection for him. He took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, together with his armor and also his sword, bow, and belt. David was successful in all the missions on which Saul sent him, and so Saul made him an officer in his army. This pleased all of Saul's officers and men. And you can imagine, Saul was he looked like a great soldier, this great, big, hulking guy. But when it came to battles, he didn't do very well. And now here's this young guy, and everything he does seemed to prosper. So which general would you like to follow around?
The successful one.
The successful one. Why not? Of course. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, following the Goliath experience, the women of Israel, and you wonder whether the devil was directly responsible for this or God had his hand in it in any way, the women of Israel began to sing that David has slain his tens of thousands, but Saul had slain only thousands. This infuriated Saul and thus began a lifelong hatred. Only once again, an evil spirit from God took control of him. Chapter 8, 1 Samuel 18, verse 10. Twice he tried to throw a spear at David while David was playing his harp for the king's benefit. I mean, imagine you're called in, you're playing your harp to try to cheer the king up, and he throws his spear at you.
Jealousy, jealousy. Take it right back to the Garden of Eden.
Yep. Yep.
Do we have any indication that Saul started messing with the devil before the Witch of Endor?
No.
You wonder whether he had a proclivity earlier on.
Yeah. Well, David was very successful. We already read that. And virtually everything the king asked him to do. So Saul became even more afraid of him. But it turns out that Jonathan was not the only member of Saul's family that fell in love with David. Michael, Saul's second daughter, also fell in love with David. So Saul invented a plan to try to destroy David. Now the first son, the first daughter, he agrees to marry off to anyone who kills Goliath. David kills Goliath, but he marries his oldest daughter off to somebody else. Now, here he finds out that his second daughter is in love with David, and David presumably is in love with her. So here's a chance to try something. He asked David to bring 100 foreskins from dead Philistines as a revenge on his enemies in exchange for his second daughter. Now, if you were the daughter, what would you think of this?
I think I have a crazy dad.
The macabre.
Saul's fortunate that he lived after all those kind of things.
Wow. Wow. David, never to be outdone, brought 200 Philistine foreskins. Try to imagine, here you are. You know, you have to prove that you did your job, right? So here's Saul, and here's David counting out foreskins. Do you think Michael was present for that occasion?
No.
I mean, you know, you think of these stories.
She's getting ready for the wedding.
She didn't
have time to count those
Would
things.
Would that have impressed her?
Things are rather basic.
And, of course, Saul became even more afraid of David. Well, then Jonathan enters the story again. He took an active part. He tried by all means possible to convince his father to leave David alone. And the chapter 19 tells all about that. Jonathan was apparently successful in convincing his father temporarily not to kill David. Meanwhile, war broke out again with the Philistines, and David defeated them. But when David returned and played his harp for Saul on another occasion, once more Saul tried to kill him with a spear. I guess we'll read once more 1 Samuel 19, 9 and 10. One day, an evil spirit from the Lord, notice this, is how many is it? Anybody count all these times?
At least four.
This is at least four or five. An evil spirit from the Lord took control of Saul. He was sitting in his house with a spear in his hand. I mean, you know, after what had happened in the past, you're David, you come in with your harp, and there's the king sitting with his spear in his hand. Would you say, ahem, ahem?
You probably keep one eye pretty close to it.
Well, what happened? Saul tried to pin David to the wall with his spear. David dodged, and the spear stuck in the wall. David ran away and escaped. That same night, Saul sent some men to watch David's house and kill him the next morning. Michael, David's wife, warned him. Now she's joining her husband against her father. She said to David, "If you don't get away tonight, tomorrow you will be dead." She let him down from a window and he ran away and escaped. Then she took the household idol.
Oh, what?
Who? what is going on here?
David had a household idol in his house?
Well, either David did or his wife did.
She might have had it hidden, yeah.
You're thinking of Rachel now, huh?
She put it to good use.
Jacob's wives had idols that they brought out of.
Well, women hide things, you know, that they don't want their husbands to see.
I see. Yeah.
Peterson puts that. Then Michael took a dummy god and put it in the bed.
Well, it says here he took his household idol, apparently looked something like a human being, laid it on the bed, put a pillow made of goat's hair at its head, and put a cover over it. When Saul's men came to get David, Michael told them, "Oh, I'm sorry, he's ill." But Saul sent them back to see David for themselves. He ordered them, "Carry him here in his bed, and I will kill him. Maybe he won't have a chance to dodge when he's sick, right?" They went inside and found the household idol in the bed and the goat's hair pillow at his head. Saul asked Michael, "Why have you tricked me like this and let my enemy escape?" She answered, "He said he would kill me if I didn't help him to escape. True or not true?"
No, but she needed an excuse.
He needed an excuse.
So that's all right to lie then.
There's a lot of lying going on in the story. David escaped and went to Samuel and Ramah and told him everything that Saul had done to him. Then he and Samuel went to Naioth and stayed there. Saul was told that David was in Naioth and Ramah. So he sent some men to arrest him. He's going to get the job done by proxy here. They saw the group of prophets dancing and shouting with Samuel as their leader. I want you to try to picture this in your minds. Then the Spirit of God took control of Saul's men, and they also began to dance and shout. Dance and shout. Okay? When Saul heard of this, he sent more messengers, and they also began to dance and shout. This is the second group. He sent messengers the third time, and the same thing happened to them. This is how you protect David, right? Everybody's dancing and shouting?
Those people that Saul sent were not that dedicated to Saul, and they just joined in on the party.
Did God take control of them?
Maybe.
Maybe they ate some rye that had ergot on it.
Well, then he's...
What does it mean?
Yeah, then he said, he himself started... Let me finish the story first.
Okay.
Then he himself started out for Ramah. When he came to the large well in Seku, he asked where Samuel and David were and was told that they were at Naioth. As he was going there, the Spirit of God took control of him also, and he danced and shouted all the way to Naioth. Now you got a whole party going on. He took off his clothes and danced and shouted in Samuel's presence and lay naked all that day and all that night. This is how the saying originated, has even Saul become a prophet? Now you know how to become a prophet. Right?
Can you explain this story? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, the cause and effect is it's kind of hard to see.
Well, the obvious thing is that God is protecting David. You know, it's clear God is protecting David in this.
Peterson puts that he's caught. They all went down and caught up in a babbling trance.
Okay.
Speaking in tongues.
Yeah. Is this? We think God is doing this. So is he just disgracing these people?
I think he's taking control of them and doing something that we don't understand today that was regarded as something being done. Now, one of the things I need to say that helps us to understand maybe the story is that in those days, if you sang in the choir, you were called a prophet.
Oh.
So maybe that's what's going on here.
So did the people of that day, did they think that this was a godly thing? Or did they think that they were...
They thought it was a godly thing.
Okay.
It seems very strange to us.
Well...
And it reminds us of one important thing, and that's that these were different times.
It's kind of similar to what was happening to the armies, mm-hmm. the Philistines. I mean... They were confused. These other guys were shouting for joy like a big party, mm-hmm. you know. And it's almost like it's some sort of miracle with a mind control or something.
Could it be extreme peer pressure when they came on these other people? They were not
took control of them.
Okay, God took control.
It sounds like
like God sent an evil spirit.
Yeah.
Sounds like they're unbalanced, and one of the first things people like that do is get rid of their clothes.
Yeah. Even today.
Yeah, well, if God's soul gets a spirit.
Well, eventually David, we know what happened. David was running for his life. Eventually David secretly found Jonathan and asked him why his father wanted to kill him. Jonathan didn't want to believe it, so a clever plan was devised to see if it was true. So what did they do? Started telling a bunch of lies. When the truth came out, Jonathan, you remember what happened. There was a festival coming up, and the king, there's a place at the table where David is supposed to sit every time, because he had become part of the king's household, and the chair is empty. The first day, the king just notices it, but doesn't say anything. The next day, the chair is empty, and so he starts asking questions, you know, and finally, the third day, where is this young man, you know? Jonathan says, oh, he asked permission to go to his father's house, because there's a festival going on. Yeah, but his father blew up. And so what did Jonathan know? His father had nothing but evil intentions, right?
Yeah.
And we read the story, and we don't have a lot of time left, but let's just look at 1 Samuel 20. Then David fled from Naioth and Ramah and went to Jonathan. What have I done here? What crime have I committed? What wrong have I done to your father to make him want to kill me? And so they set this whole deal up. Verses 5 through... 7, please do me this favor and keep the sacred promise you made to me. But if I'm guilty, kill me yourself. Why take me to your father to be killed? Don't even think such a thing, Jonathan answered. If I knew for certain that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you? David then asked, who will let me know if your father answers you angrily? Let's go out to the field, Jonathan answered. So they went, and Jonathan said to David, may the Lord God of Israel be our witness. At this time tomorrow and on the following day, I will question my father. If his attitude towards you is good, I will send you word. If he intends to harm you, may the Lord strike me dead if I don't let you know about it and get you safely away. So, you mean, David has had two members of Saul's family protected his life here. Two of them.
And look how close Jonathan is to God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. May the Lord be with you as he was with my father. And if I remain alive, and please keep, if I remain alive, please keep your sacred promise and be loyal to me. But if I die, show the same kind of loyalty to my family forever. And when the Lord has completely destroyed all your enemies, may our promise to each other still be unbroken. If it is broken, the Lord will punish you. So these guys, they really liked each other. And they made promises to each other. And, of course, Jonathan found out that his father was very hostile toward David. So he had to go out and tell David, sorry, you better get out of here. Twice, we know, over the next 10 years, while Saul was off and on pursuing David, David had the opportunity to kill him, but he didn't. On at least one occasion, Jonathan found David in one of his hiding places, and they had a wonderful but short time together. And that's 1 Samuel 23:14-18. Let's just read that. That's a very nice passage. David stayed in hiding in the hill country in the wilderness near Ziph. Saul was always trying to find him, but God did not hand David over to him. David saw that Saul was out to kill him. David was at Horesh in the wilderness near Ziph. Jonathan went to him there and encouraged him with the assurances of God's protection, saying to him, "Don't be afraid. My father Saul won't be able to harm you. He knows very well that you are the one who will be the king of Israel, and I will be next in rank to you." And I'm sure David would have been so happy if that had been true, if that had worked out. We know it didn't. The two of them made a sacred promise of friendship to each other. David stayed at Horesh, and Jonathan went home. What happened? Some people from Ziph reported on the experience, and Saul is down there trying to kill him in Ziph. Well, try to imagine the conflicts that went through the mind of Jonathan as he watched his father's increasing hatred for David. Did Jonathan understand this, that his father was mentally ill? You know, you asked about what kind of illness. I mean, you know, here's someone who's your very best soldier, the closest and dearest friend of your eldest son, married to your second daughter. I mean, why are you trying to kill him? Well, the next time we hear of Jonathan was at the time of another war with the Philistines. Following his father's desperate attempt to communicate with God in Saul's nighttime visit to the witch of Endor. Now, we don't have time to go through all those details. What happened? He kept asking God in different ways, and God didn't respond. So finally he says, "I've got to get Samuel back." Samuel was dead by this time. He goes to the witch of Endor, and secretly, without letting her know who was there, and asks her to call up Samuel from the dead. You know that whole story. And that next morning, when he gets back to the battle, Saul and three of his sons, Jonathan, beloved Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, were killed on Mount Gilboa. It tells the story of 1 Samuel 30:1-7. Saul, having been wounded, actually fell on his sword and committed suicide so the Philistines wouldn't be able to finally kill him. Notice a very interesting comment about why Saul died in 1 Chronicles 10:13-14. Look at that. Well, first of all, just notice that it's not like the author of 1 Chronicles knows what he's talking about. If you start at the top, it says the Philistines fought a battle against the Israelites on Mount Gilboa. Many Israelites were killed there, and the rest of them, including King Saul and his sons, fled. But the Philistines caught up with them and killed three of Saul's sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting was heavy around Saul, and he was hit by enemy arrows and badly wounded. He said to the young man carrying his weapons, "Draw your sword and kill me to keep these godless Philistines from gloating over me." But the young man was too terrified to do it. So Saul took his own sword and threw himself on it. The young man saw that Saul was dead, so he too threw himself on his sword and died. So Saul and his three sons all died together, and none of his descendants ever ruled. And I'm going to skip down now to 13-14. Saul died because he was unfaithful to the Lord. I thought he died of a sword wound. He disobeyed the Lord's commands. He tried to find guidance by consulting the spirits of the dead instead of consulting the Lord, so the Lord killed him and gave the control of the kingdom to David, son of Jesse. Did God kill him?
That's what
God does everything.
God does everything. Okay? Even if you fall on your sword, it's God's fault?
God does everything in this culture. Mm-hmm. That's what we said.
So What do we do about other passages that talk about God doing strange things?
Doesn't God just withdraw his protection and so you're left to what is happening?
Well, did God send the evil spirits?
That's what the Bible said.
Well, it says God killed Saul here, but we know exactly how he died. So which is the story?
The wages of sin is death. Saul started to stray quite early on. It just got worse over a longer time.
So how could you say, would it be fair to say that God killed him?
No, I think Saul brought it on himself.
Bible says God killed him.
You go to 2 Samuel chapter 1, and it's an Amalekite says, hey, I'm the one that killed him.
Yeah.
So you got three stories about the death of Saul.
Yeah.
Whereas they killed the Amalekite who brought the message because you weren't supposed to kill the king. Mm-hmm. And to this day, they generally don't kill government leaders, presidents and kings and so forth. They put them off into exile or something like that.
Ken, can you tell us what you think?
Well, when Jonathan found out the news from the, I mean, sorry, when David found out the news from the battle, he wept and composed a lament for the dead king of Jonathan, his best friend. That's found in 2 Samuel 1, 17 to 27. Thus ended one of the great friendships in the Bible. Jonathan chose a life that was great in the sight of God instead of men. Why did he do that? How can we inspire our young people today to make a similar choice? And I read these inspired words. Jonathan, by birth heir to the throne, yet knowing himself set aside by the divine decree to his rival, the most tender and faithful of friends, shielding David's life at the peril of his own, steadfast at his father's side through the dark days of his declining power, and at his side falling at the last. The name of Jonathan is treasured in heaven, and it stands on earth as a witness to the existence and the power of unselfish love. I think that's marvelous. So what should we learn from the life of this unselfish friend of God? Compare his experience to that of John the Baptist as he deferred to Jesus. We as Christians need to understand the power of love. And we need to see, we need to act like this, and we need to see this kind of action in other people's lives in our day. See you next week.